5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome to Life in the Foam, the podcast about living outside of the mainstream media bubbles here in the 21st century. It's my pleasure to welcome Professor Paul Levinson of Media Studies at Fordham University. He's an expert on Marshall McLuhan. He wrote The Digital McLuhan and is also a science fiction author, writer of The Silk Code, and many other stories. I had the pleasure of meeting Professor Levinson last week at the relaunch event, for the new print edition of Amazing Stories of Science Fiction magazine. So thanks for joining me, Professor.
Hey, it's my pleasure. And I have to say, you know, it was a really auspicious occasion last week. I can't think of a better time to meet an up-and-coming eminent podcaster, because as I probably mentioned last week, but in case our audience didn't know, my very first fully professional publication of a science fiction story, you know, I had a couple in like semi-prozines, as they're called, but my first fully professional publication was in Amazing Stories, a piece called Albert's Cradle, a short story. And this was way back in 1993. So I was especially delighted to come up to Toronto last week for the relaunch event for the new Amazing Stories, which has my latest story, time travel story, Slipping Time. And it was icing on the cake that you and I had a chance to talk. Good connection.
Absolutely. So this is the fourth episode of this podcast, and I've been trying to find a way to really dig into the meat of Marshall McLuhan, because I'm sure lots of people, especially people I talk to, don't quite know who I'm talking about. So maybe we should just start off with a basic introduction to who was Marshall McLuhan. He was a professor at the University of Toronto who taught English, importantly, and he brought all sorts of poetry and artistic interpretation skills into reading modern media like advertisements and whatnot, and sort of founded the whole science of media ecology. Would you call that a fair summation?
Yeah, very fair summation. And, you know, he was really someone who was almost prescient about the digital age that we're now in. Now, it's not that he had some kind of extrasensory perception or he was some kind of mystic. But Marshall McLuhan was so in touch with the way human beings communicated that he realized, for example, as soon as the Telstar satellite was launched back in the early 60s, that even though, in fact, it would wind up taking decades for this to happen, that this was the beginning of a global village of communication. And, you know, just to be clear, back in the 1960s, there were national television audiences. You know, people in the United States were all watching the same thing. People in Canada were watching a little of what the United States was watching, but also Canadian things, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the BBC was in England. But there really were no international communication communities. And I always like citing this notion of the global village that McLuhan came up with to show how tuned in he was to what was going on with human communication and the technologies that we invented. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Digital McLuhan, which was written in the late 1990s, first published by Routledge Press in 1991, I called it Digital McLuhan deliberately, because the point I was making is that decades prior to the digital age, you know, the first personal computers didn't come around until maybe the early 1980s. So we're talking about a good two decades before that. In 1962, in the Gutenberg Galaxy, here McLuhan starts talking about the global village. And that's the way he was about everything. He was teeming with insights. And, you know, I think I was saying last week to you and other people in Toronto that Toronto has always been one of my favorite cities in the world. I guess New York City is my favorite, but the only other two cities that are even in the running are Toronto and London. And one of the reasons why I so love Toronto is Marshall McLuhan was up in Toronto. And my wife Tina and I went up to visit him a bunch of times. We had dinner over his house. And I always tell people, you know, obviously you and I are people who love conversation, but boy, no one I've ever met in my life love conversation as much as McLuhan. And within 10 seconds, he could hit you with some kind of insight that was just pouring out of his head, like, oh, he said to me one day, you know, the automobile retrieves the knight in shining armor. So, you know, at first you think, what is he talking about? What does an automobile have to do? But as soon as you begin thinking about it, this McLuhan probe, you realize that he was onto something. Because, you know, when we get in our automobiles, and again, especially in the early 1960s, these big cars with the tail fins and so on, you were, in the 1960s, the equivalent of a knight all decked out in his armor in, I don't know, like 1250 A.D. And he just kept pouring out these insights. One day he called me and said, you know, I just wrote a piece. I just wanted to let you know about it. And this is also one of my favorites. He says, you know, what the telephone has done. And this now, by this time, it's like the late 1970s, and McLuhan and I are in touch. What the telephone has done, he says, is it's made the outside the only place where we can be private. So again, what is he talking about? And of course, instantly you realize that, you know, he's right, because if you're home, and look, just today, even here in 2018, you know, I don't know, these nutcases get your numbers. They call you up with their nonsense. You know, you block them, they just call back again. So here you are in the privacy of your home. You don't have any privacy from the outside world. But McLuhan's point was, when you're outside, not in your home, you do have privacy. And of course, I was quick to jump on this thought in the late 1990s and since then, because with the advent of cell phones, which I love dearly, but now we have no privacy of the outside world either, because anybody can call us on our cell phone. So that's what McLuhan was all about, just to give a couple of examples. You know, I could talk about what McLuhan was all about probably for the next 100 hours, and I wouldn't run out of examples.
I might take you up on that. So these insights, I suppose they poured from, well, he made this differentiation between percepts and concepts. So I suppose McLuhan was about was all about the end of linear thinking, or rational, uptight, repressed sort of logical thought that was part of, according to him, much of the Enlightenment thought, especially in America, which was a country founded on books, right? So logical thinking was brought on by the book, and then the television was going to turn everyone into a more perceptive person who puts things together for themselves, right? Who is gazing upon the mosaic of all sorts of information and is left to make up their own pattern recognition and whatnot. So what McLuhan had with all these insights was his perception, is his attempt to try to have his own poetic style interpretations of the medium themselves. Like, he's reading the real world as though it were an art piece or a movie to be interpreted, right? Does that seem like a fair...
Yes, 100%. In fact, McLuhan and I once had a conversation in which he said, you know, you're a logic boy. You know, you deal in concepts and you write in a very linear way, but you get it. And he was like puzzled about why someone who was a logic boy, as he put it, would get it. And then like his eyes lit up. And his eyes lit up like no one else's eyes lit up. You could literally see, you know, his brain working. He says, ah, I know, you know, how it is that you get it. Even though you're a logic boy, you're also a musician. And, you know, he knew about my album, Twice Upon a Rhyme. And by the way, I'm doing a new album of science fiction related songs. It's going to be released on Old Bear Records and sometime in 2019. So music has always been a part of my life. And that was how McLuhan explained the fact that I got his percepts, because you're completely right. He really had a lot of criticism, almost verging on contempt, for what he saw as like this restricted linear thinking. And truthfully, you know, I do have, I have 2 feet, so it's not surprising I have a foot in both realms. And, you know, I love poetry. I appreciate McLuhan. I have nothing but contempt for his critics who can't deal with his poetry. And I often say people who don't understand McLuhan, they're either stupid, jealous, lazy, or both. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hate to even say that now because it almost sounds Trumpian, but it is true of a lot of McLuhan's critics, these people who are locked into their linear way of thinking. And they couldn't get into the Gutenberg galaxy or understanding media. What kind of a book is this? They were talking about the Gutenberg galaxy. What, the chapters are just a page or two. He has, you know, it was like 160, whatever it is, you know, chapters with titles that are themselves, you know, more than titles. It was a new form of writing. It was McLuhan's attempt to break the written word out of the Procrustean bed that it had been put in and still is in many cases. So, yeah, you're completely right. You know, McLuhan disliked concepts. He trafficked in percepts, and that is indeed why he was so effervescent, you know, this bubbling of ideas. But, you know, as you know from my, you know, writing, McLuhan wasn't wrong about me. I am a logic boy. Mm-hmm. I do like logic. I do like concepts. And in fact, I don't think there's a necessary conflict between the two. And in many ways, McLuhan was reacting against the criticism that he got and people he admired got. By the way, I should mention that Harold Innes, who is generally and correctly recognized as McLuhan's main mentor, he wrote in a very linear way also. You know, so if you read The Bias of Communication, Empire and Communication, you know, Innes' great books, which, by the way, I highly recommend. They're brilliant, and they're foundations of McLuhan's thought. You find someone who's dealing with concepts who writes in a much more linear way. At the same time, though, McLuhan was inspired by James Joyce. He loved quoting James Joyce. And in general, McLuhan thought the poet was a better conduit and a better guide to understanding what was going on, not only in the world of media, but in the world period, than, you know, the traditional linear writer, than the philosopher, you know, even more than most professors, sad to say.
Yes.
So, you know, that indeed captures McLuhan.
From Cliché to Archetype, McLuhan has this book about the idea of how the clichés of today in culture are later on in later decades pulled back from the rag and bones shop of the past history, which is now forgotten, pulled back as expressions, as metaphors for the new thing. As that's the way that a cliché today becomes an archetype tomorrow, right? And
yep.
So as far as the poetry goes, in that book he relates it to a book called The Lamp and the Mirror, which is all about how 18th century poets like Coleridge, for instance, talks about this dichotomy between whether your mind works as a mirror, which is merely your senses are mirroring what's going on outside, versus whether this old pre-optical science notion of the mind as a lamp, where your eyes have light that shine out and illuminate, and you're sort of co-creating your perceptions, right? You're creating reality as you see it and as you enunciate it, right? So it's sort of this whole idea of you know, like the inner, you know, light that shines, which a lot of Western, like a lot of Western culture is built on this parallel, right? Versus the person who merely mirrors the outside. So when McLuhan brings up that topic, it really goes to illustrate how a poet can be sort of someone who creates meaning out of their sensory imagery. So which gets me to the idea of the medium versus the content, because one of McLuhan's famous aphorisms is the medium is the message, or the medium is the massage, or the medium is the mass age, right? And there's that Joycean influence of multiple punnings and layers, right?
Yeah, the tedium is the message, he sometimes said that too.
yeah. So my whole shtick for the past year, I've been working on this YouTube series called Silicon and Charybdis, where I'm trying to reveal digital computers as what they are, as a configuration of highly complex electronic circuits, which work, which, I mean, the original computers were built out of telegraph relays, right? It's about the instead of an analog signal, where the power levels fluctuate in accordance to, say, sound waves, or according to the intensity of a light dot on a cathode ray tube, a digital circuit, the state of the circuit is constantly changing click, 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 click to the tempo of a clock speed, right? So I've got a 2 gigahertz computer here, so, you know, 2 billion times a second, this whole configuration of circuits is going click, 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 procedurally changing one after another, in a way which is interruptible by inputs and outputs, right? You could have a closed state computer that, you know where it's going, but computers are special because after the orientation of all the circuits has been pulled up by its own bootstraps, so to speak, all the circuits have to be in a relation to every other circuit. We're talking millions of circuits that all have to be related to one to each other in a logical pattern. So that configuration is bootstrapped, and then input and output can interrupt that configuration, and somehow, at the end of the day, it all results in meaningful pixels that give us, pictures and images and sound waves, and here I am talking to you, right? So I've been really trying to dig into the human history of how this evolved, because I'm rather worried about people looking at machines as things with agency, as opposed to things which are created and controlled and understood, and computer literacy is, I think, a huge part of talking about Marshall McLuhan. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I do. But first, let me just touch base on one of the earlier points that you made, this cliche to archetype. And, people often forget that McLuhan was not only a futurist, that is, he was writing about the future, as we were just discussing in terms of the Global Village, but he was an incredibly well-versed, encyclopedically versed historian. And so that's, where this cliched archetype came from. And I have to say, there's almost not a day that goes by in my life that I don't think of an example of how something from the past has now become much more in the present. I was just talking to my class at Fordham University the other day, my digital media and public responsibility class, about how the Nazis and their notion of Lügenpresse, lying press, and I'm not the first person to point this out, but to put in the McLuhan-esque framework, to some extent that's a cliche. If you're talking about the Lügenpresse in the 60s, 70s, Hitler was gone, the Nazis were gone. But now it's come back in an incredibly big way. It's become an archetype of our time in fake news. Mm-hmm. And, when the American president, Donald Trump, denounces any news that he doesn't like as fake news, he is doing exactly what Joseph Goebbels and Adolf Hitler did back in the 30s whenever the press published things that they didn't want. So this cliched archetype is really, I'm glad that McLuhan used it as a title of one of his books, because it's one of his most important concepts. Now, in terms of what you're talking about, let me just say in general, I think it's extremely important that you are looking at the hardware in terms of what is making our digital lives possible. For a variety of reasons, it's hardware usually is not as easy to understand as software, and it's not on the surface. And again, this is, the medium is the message. Most people look at the content, what the hardware delivers. And, they know that the hardware is there, but either they're not interested or they just don't have the ability or for whatever reason to focus on it. And there are many, many examples. I haven't delved into computers the way you have, but one of the things that I frequently talk about is – it's very obvious, but it's not often talked about. You talk about social media, and, I always point out, and, other people point this out, that if you think about the appearance of social media, how new they are in our world. So, in particular, Twitter and YouTube, where this, podcast is going to be posted. You talk about 2006, 12 years ago. But still, YouTube and Twitter are content. They are media which have their own content, but they themselves are content. They're apps that live and work on hardware. And no one talks really about what kind of computer does Twitter store its material on. One of the things that I've tried to shed a little light on, that's again why I'm happy to see you looking at that deeper hardware, is, you know, just the fact that the iPhone is not introduced until 2007. And the iPhone is a crucial component in the advent of social media, or what I call new media. New media being digital media, new media. So in other words, Amazon, if you buy a book, an old-fashioned printed book on Amazon, that's new media. Mm-hmm. But if I write a book and I put it up there as a Kindle, Amazon has become new media, because I'm not only using Amazon to buy books, I'm using it to create a book that I put out there to the world. And as we know on Twitter, people use Twitter all the time to create information and put their words on Twitter. Again, that typifies Donald Trump's presidency in many ways, but it typifies many, many things. But most of that is done, if we're talking about Twitter, on smartphones. And so the iPhone and what it did in 2007 is crucial. In fact, when the iPhone was first introduced, one of the things I realized is what the smartphone does is it exiles useless places from our lives. And here's what I mean. We're waiting for something, right? Whatever it is, we could be waiting in an airport. We could be waiting online in a store. We could even be in an elevator, waiting for an elevator in a skyscraper. Those are useless places, meaning that we can't do much, right? The elevator is in many ways the worst. We're a captive audience, both waiting for the elevator and even more so when we go in the elevator. But with a smartphone in our hands, suddenly that's no longer a useless place. Mm-hmm. And so that's just an example of how that hardware works. And, you know, I think that what you're probing, looking at what's inside, you know, the digital connections in the computer, that's not a footnote or an afterthought. That's a probe of the very essence of the digital world we live in. And it's the same as, okay, you and I are talking, we both have minds, we have personalities, we say things, but who we are is integrally and intimately tied into our physical bodies. In fact, there was a French philosopher, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and he had a great phrase. I won't bother your listeners or viewers with the French, but the English translation is the metaphysics of the flesh. And so what Merleau-Ponty was talking about is you can't understand human intelligence without understanding the situation of our brains in our bodies. It's not just, you know, a minor point. And that's why, again, what you're doing with you know, computers is very, very crucial. I've written a little bit about artificial intelligence, and, you know, my own, you know, I guess influenced by McLuhan, I've come up with a lot of puns. They're usually lamer than McLuhan's. But I think that if you are talking about human mentality without talking about flesh, without talking about the physical being, you're putting Descartes before the horse.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God! You'll probably lose like half your listeners as a result of that. Anyhow, so I am very interested in your work. I'm gonna read more of it, and I hope you continue doing it. And I have to say, you know, just to give you a little advice, putting on my researcher and professor hat, the more original and unusual your work, the more difficult it is to get it out there. Again, the Amazon Kindle, YouTube changed that. So you're able to get your work up on the web. You can put something out on Amazon, on YouTube. But traditional publishers, unfortunately, they don't know what's going on. Every once in a while, you find a publisher who does. But I'll never forget, you know, after McLuhan died in December 1980, I knew an editor. I'm not going to mention his name. I don't want to embarrass him. I have no idea whether he's even still alive, but I'll mention the press. It was St. Martin's Press. And I called him up. I said, you know, you probably heard Marshall McLuhan passed away. He said, yeah. And I said, you know, I've written a couple of articles about him. He said, yeah, I've come across them. I said, I have an idea for a book about McLuhan. Mm-hmm. And he said, McLuhan is finished. It's 1981. No one is going to be interested in his work. He had, his time in the 60s. So anyway, that book eventually became Digital McLuhan. But, unfortunately, there's an inverse relationship between the originality, of what researchers like you are doing and how easy it is to get other people to recognize it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I get that advice also from a different vector, because I'm very much part of understanding the hardware and understanding the software as content is the notion of free software. Richard Stallman's idea of, software where the user has a legal entitlement to see the source code of the programs they're using. So operating systems like GNU Linux, for instance. And nobody wants to hear about that. I get told again and again and again, man, you're going to bore everyone to tears. No one cares about free software. People just want to use their phone. People just want to use their computer. They don't care how it works. They don't care about this legal contract, right? So I appreciate what you're right. I suppose it's going to take some art to make this interesting and accessible, which I guess is kind of what I'm trying to do here, because it is a very human story. And so, we talk about, Edison, and we talk about Nikola Tesla as great inventors, but then as soon as the inventions and the innovations turn microscopic, or as soon as they become these abstract things happening in a cyberspace, which seems to be divorced or floating away from physical reality, that's when all the public awareness or excitement stops, right? All the excitement moves towards the marketing of the feature list on this new app that you just update, and oh, it does this for me, oh, it does that for me, not here's how it does it, right?
Yes. Well, it's interesting. A long time ago, this goes back, I mean, it's actually just a couple of years before Digital McLuhan, my first really well-known book, The Soft Edge, A Natural History and Future of the Information Revolution. I have a chapter in there about intellectual property. And just to be clear, I agree with you. I don't think money is the most important thing, although I do have sympathy for the point of view that people should get paid for their creations. So I wouldn't say I'm in favor of giving everything away completely free. But for example, as an author, I'm delighted that my books are in libraries where people can take them out for free. I don't mind if people buy my books and I get, a royalty of money for it. So again, I have a foot in both worlds. But what does interest me about intellectual property and speaks directly to the point you're making is credit for the work. So I don't mind, and I would never sue anyone if somehow someone stole one of my books or whatever and didn't pay for it. As a matter of fact, there's like an old joke. I mean, I think I once, I can't remember exactly what happened. It was back when I was teaching at Fairleigh Dickinson University. Oh, yeah, I remember now. And there was a professor who came into my office. He was all upset because his car was stolen. Somebody stole his car. And he mentioned, as an especial grievance. And, I had a whole box of my books that were just, one of his books had just been published. I had a whole box of my books in the trunk. And I said to him, so what are you so upset about? So this guy who stole it, he'll probably be very interested, in your books. So so maybe that was pushing it a little bit too much. But what would bother me is if somebody took one of my books and somehow put their title in as the author. And this speaks exactly to your point. We all know who Steve Jobs is. We know who Bill Gates is. On that level, we know who Jeff Bezos is. We know who Elon Musk is. Those people at the very, very, very top, they receive all the publicity. But they didn't actually invent all those things. And, I support a lot of what Elon Musk does. I'm a great advocate. You and I haven't even talked about this, of human beings getting out into space. I actually published an anthology with a co-editor, Michael Waltemoth, called Touching the Face of the Cosmos on the intersection of space travel and religion. I think we need to bring religion, not that I'm such a devout religious person, I'm not at all, but I think that religion, could be something something that could be usefully plugged into this. I think this incredibly important need that we have to get off this planet, not leave the planet, but some of us get off the planet and begin to explore the universe. So I like Elon Musk a lot. I support his work, but here's, you know, what I'm saying that relates to your point. I would like to know the names of the people who worked on the various projects that make the SpaceX possible. Mm-hmm. You know, or for that matter, the Tesla automobile. And so in this, you know, chapter on intellectual property in the Soft Edge, published, again, way back in 1997, not that long ago, but it seems like, you know, it is the last, you know, century. I make the point that it will be trivially easy in any app that we see. We didn't call them apps back then, we called them programs, but it would be trivially easy for the person who invented it, all the people who invented it, to see their names. Mm-hmm. And even though it's trivially easy, you don't usually see this. You know, the only place I see this is Photoshop, as a matter of fact. You know, if you call in Photoshop, right, you see a list of like 500 names of everyone who worked on it, but good. Yeah. That's the point. And I think inventions don't happen accidentally, meaning even if they're an accident, it takes a human being to say, ah, I can see how this could work. They certainly don't arise in nature. You know, maybe you could say mutations are inventions, but I don't think there's a mind behind mutations. They just happen. And because inventions are human, I think it would help our world a lot if the human beings who created the apps along the lines you're talking about receive credit for it. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they're free or not, that's a different issue. I mean, you probably heard of Stewart Brand and the Whole Earth catalog, you know, and his famous phrase, information wants to be free. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The first time I heard him talking about that, I remember I was like on a panel with him, and when it was my turn to pipe up, of course, I usually say something provocative. Why else would I be there? I said, well, Stuart, you know, information may want to be free, but creators of information need to eat. And, you know, again, we have to find a balance between those two things. Charging a fortune for an app, making it not available to people who are indigent, that's not the way to go. Mm-hmm. But nor, I think, should everything be totally, you know, free. So there has to be a way that we can get a combination of both, I think.
Right, right. Well, I don't expect everyone, or even, like, everyone to use the computer the way that I do, right? So, for instance, I'm not thinking in terms of specific programs. I'm thinking in terms of, you know, file formats and protocols, right? Okay, I need to edit this audio file. I need to extract the audio from this video file, right? There's 27 different tools to do that. I'll use whatever one I've got, right? So it's like, when you've been using a computer long enough, there's just these general principles, as opposed to someone who, they go to Google, they type, you know, MP3 extractor program, and the first five ones on the list, you know, it's like, oh, here's the free trial version, right? And that's your the method of using a computer. That's the way most people are going to do it.
Yes.
There's a whole history of speaking of giving credit to the inventors or ideas. One person who I'm focusing on in Silicon and Cribs is Alan Kay, who worked at Xerox PARC, which he's the guy who thought of instead of the contents of a computer being telegraphy equipment or, you know, the doot-doot-doot, basically, because computers basically grew up as extensions of the telegraph, or which became the teletype and the teleprinter, which was like a modified typewriter. And he's the guy who said, no, let's create this virtual abstract space, the Macintosh model of icons that, you know, Windows has, right? He came up with all these metaphors for this virtual space, and then they tried and then found a way to make the hardware fit that model. And this was the invention of object-oriented programming, which is how nearly everything is done today. And the idea of the software in your computer being built up like Lego blocks, you know? Just this whole cognitive model where everything in the computer is abstract and humanly meaningful. So this is the invention of cyberspace, but when I use my computer, I'm not running Windows or Mac OS, so all of my programs, like you said, in the About box, you can see a list of all of the developers, and then you can go see what parts they contributed, and you can go read their code, right? So free software is an entire community of people building things in their spare time or at work. I mean, most of the free software is developed by companies like Intel and IBM and Microsoft and Red Hat and SUSE, and they're all government projects. It's interesting because if you want to learn computers, you can have it all for free. But for the most part, the market model is still going to exist for a long time coming, where the App Store, you know, throws a couple bucks to the developers. It's interesting because I'm going to be soliciting sponsors for this podcast on Patreon.com. If you like this content, shoot me some bucks on Patreon.com. And you hear that more and more and more if you're on the internet today. This idea of the retrieval of the artistic patronship model of funding art and funding content creation. Because right. When we have these platforms, which is the new term for website app hybrid, right? Everything's a platform nowadays, right? YouTube, Twitter, they are beholden to advertisers, and they have an obligation to regulate and keep, you know, their platform, you know, sort of clean and appropriate and socially responsible in the same way that newspapers or traditional magazines have. Whereas in the larger digital milieu, it's kind of a wild free-for-all, which is where I grew up, right? So I think this is definitely where we can tie this back to the notion of fake news, just the obligations of reporters to, you know, adhere to journalistic ethics and whatnot, and to rely on authoritative sources and to use the best information, is all sort of, you know, surrounded on all sides by the free-for-alls of random people with a computer, which I'm kind of terming life in the foam. People outside who for one reason or another are talking to everyone and getting their brains scrambled trying to figure out the truth if they step outside of news, right? So
yeah. Well, I mean, a couple of things. You said a lot of significant things. Let me just say another plug for smartphones. So as I mentioned, I write songs, and I got this free app called Record or Record It. So it means if I'm sitting down at the piano writing a song, you know, the lyrics are obviously easy enough to write down, but I want to make sure I remember, you know, and I could write down the chords, but you know, it takes a long time to write down the actual melody. I can do music notation, but this free app, you know, on my phone, I just turn it on. And, you know, so I wrote a song, Samantha, can't you see that? Anyway, and so I'm not going to forget that because, you know, I have this little free app. Or another example, I'll give you two other examples of great apps on the phone. Here in New York City, I'm sure Toronto is the same. There's no big city that doesn't have these meters, downtown or whatever, meaning you park, you got to plunk in. You know, at best, you know, maybe it's going to be like a quarter for 15 minutes. And for years, you know, my wife and I have been saying, here, you know, we're going downtown, we're going to have dinner with some people. And, you know, by the time we park in the car, it's only at the meter. You can only put an hour's worth of money into the meter. Then you have to come back and feed it with more money.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course, you know, I'm right in the middle of dinner making a scintillating point, as I am to you right now. And, the alarm goes off in my phone. I have to run out like an idiot and plunk more quarters in.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, about 7 or 8 months ago, and obviously New York City is doing this because it helps them make more money, but still, it's a free app. And now, when that kind of thing happens, what you do is you photograph a number that's on the meter after you put the money in, and then you're in the restaurant, you call in the app, you put in the number, press it, and boom, it's like being there putting in the quarters.
Yeah.
So that's an example of a free app. Here's another app I'll give a plug to. I can't think of the exact name of it, but Blogspot or Blogger is where I have my blog, Paul Levinson's Infinite Regress. And truthfully, I write my blogs on my laptop because I like the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm the kind of person, whether I'm writing a song or a science fiction story or a blog or a book or anything, certainly after I write the first draft, which I put up there, I'm changing it. And sometimes even later, I'm changing it. And not only that, I go swimming every day. And when I'm swimming, I come up with great ideas. So for $5, $5, I bought this blogger app from some place, I think, in India. And it allows me to log into my blog and make whatever changes I want, and it's there on the blog, $5. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's not free, but it's pretty close to free. So I think in terms of what you're correctly concerned about, and I know exactly what you're talking about because I've done some of that too. You search, you know, okay, I want an app that's going to capture on the screen, you know, anything I see, and I want a video here. Okay, great. Download the free version. Oh, unfortunately, it only records the first 2 minutes. I have something to watch record something a half an hour. That's okay. $45, $50, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, I've bought that, and I agree with you. Those things should be less. But I think, in general, smartphones are leading the way to a better world, you know, where the apps are either free or they're very inexpensive.
Well, yes, yes. There's free as in price, but as Richard Stallman's fond of saying, there's free as in freedom, which means can you take the source code or does the law say no reverse engineering allowed, right? So, right, I mean, it's a really nerdy sort of thing to obsess over, but when there are stories about, you know, applications that are stealing your personal data and no one knows and Apple has to remove this app from the App Store because it turns out it was mining bitcoins on your phone for someone else, right, overseas or whatnot, right? There's all these sort of, the idea, I like being able to see, or the idea that I can trust other people to look down through the interface, straight to the code, straight down to the metal so that you know what you're looking at. I think McLuhan was very apt when he said, it's the job of the artist to tell everyone what it is that their environment is made out of, right? And so I can say today, I'll tell you what your environment is made out of if you let me see the source code, or if you let me take the source code to someone who can read it, right? And who can change it for me, right? There's this element of freedom, which is directly curtailed by the smartphone industry as it exists today. Mm-hmm. So it's not about price, right? You can pay money for free software with a capital F, but so I'll be exploring this later on in my work to come, but just to let you know that's the direction that I'm taking this.
All right, well, that's an interesting hypothesis. You know, I'll have to think about that, but I think I'm generally in favor of that. And just so I'm clear, what you are saying is you see no reason why, whether the app is free or inexpensive, why the owner, the purchaser of the app, can't drill down, see the source code, and maybe improve it a little bit for his or her own purposes.
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I think, you know, I mean, the law is beginning to change on that. Mm-hmm. There was a time when there was, you know, that was like universally not possible.
Well, but I think the hobbyist community of the in the 70s worked on this way. It was called the hacker ethos, right? It was just taken for granted that everyone shared everything, right? And so the hobbyist community today still works that way. It's just as Neil Stephenson wrote in his book, First There Was the Command Line, I think is what it's called. In the Beginning, There Was the Command Line by Neil Stephenson. And
Snow Crash, is that the book?
The author of Snow Crash. Yes. He wrote this book exploring the idea of free software as a bunch of nerds on the side of the road selling tanks for free, giving away tanks across the street from the Apple dealership and across the street from the Microsoft dealership. Right. Everyone's going to the Apple dealership where they're getting their custom fancy computers while the nerds are saying, hey, take our free stuff. And no one wants it because it's ugly and hard to use, right?
Right.
Which has kind of been, you know. See, that's the computers I grew up in my whole life. So this podcast is called Life in the Foam because I'm trying to, articulate that the digital environment around us is so much more abstract and complicated than you would get from A Consumer Reports magazine and the news reporter who told you to tell us what you think about us on, you know, Twitter, and everyone goes and they buy an Apple phone and they join Twitter.
Right.
And now we have these flame wars and people's lives being ruined over Twitter drama, and you've got all these trolls, which, from my perspective, that was predictable. But that's because I grew up in a different digital environment, right? I was the nerdy kid watching movies on my pocket PC in 2003, 5 years before everyone else started doing the same thing on their iPhone, right? So it's like... Mm-hmm. Canary in the coal mine here, talking to everyone else. I know where this is going, right?
Right. Well, couple of things. I don't see how access to source code is going to stop the idiots who are screaming and yelling at each other on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But that aside, one of the things which I think, I don't think McLuhan talked that much about it, but I talk a lot about it. Years ago, I tried to come up with an example of a technology that was undeniably completely bad. So the first thing that came to my mind was the gun. And actually, I do think here in the United States, our laws are insane. You know, we need to have far less guns out there, as in almost none in public hands. And I'm sure some people, if they hear this, are going to go ballistic, but too bad, they're wrong. But I don't think the gun is an ipso facto evil technology, because I can imagine how the gun, you know, you could be out in the forest and, you know, there are no plants around to eat and you're glad to have a gun. You know, I love little rabbits, but I don't want to starve to death. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to get a rabbit by throwing a rock at it. So, all right, so then you can move it up. What about... nuclear weapons. I mean, they're pretty atrocious. You don't need nuclear weapons to eat. But nuclear energy has done good things, right? I mean, you can use nuclear energy in a safe way, sometimes for power. It has good medical effects. So no matter how far you go, you can't think of something that is just ipso facto bad in a technology. So what about the other way? All right, a good technology. How about a pillow, right? Well, in the hands of a homicidal maniac, a pillow can be used to suffocate
somebody.
Even
a pillow, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So how about medicine, you know, vaccine? Unfortunately, that science is also the basis for germ warfare, understanding, you know, how bacteria, viruses, whatever attack the body. So there's no such thing as an ipso facto good technology.
No.
Therefore, ergo, I think all technologies in one way or another are knives, literally two-edged swords. They can be used to cut food good. They can be used to cut people bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and to get back to your point, that is true of Twitter. That's true even when the source code is available. It is intrinsic to technology that ultimately, it's the human use of it that determines whether it's good or bad. That doesn't mean that it wouldn't be very helpful for society for some technologies to be strongly limited, like the availability of guns. But it does mean that when you're talking about something like Twitter, short of basically banning human beings from Twitter, and that would mean it wouldn't exist anymore, you're going to have people who abuse it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing you can do about that. And it's basically a hopeless case. You know, Twitter and Facebook and, you know, they all try, you know, I mean, Twitter, I guess, is the most libertarian because they have the greatest tolerance for some really disgusting people.
They took the longest to ban Alex Jones out of all the rest of them. You know,
Exactly. So, but you know what? That's not going to solve the problem because there are other Alex Joneses out there, and that's basically the point.
Mm-hmm.
What technologies do is magnify humanity and human impulse. And I think just as human beings can do good and bad, so the technologies enable that.
Right. I think that's very true, and technologies enable that because technologies are extensions of us. Right? Ray McLuhan was very fond of saying, you know, the foot is an extension, or rather, the wheel is an extension of the foot, and whatnot. And then electric media is an extension of our nervous system.
That's
And
right.
And I'm beginning to think that I'd like to think of the availability, the fact that everyone has a cheap digital camera. Like how long have cameras been digital? How long have they had screens that let you actually see immediately what it is you just recorded? This is personal instant replay technology. It's a mirror, right? So
that's right.
Every person has their own ability to instantiate their face, their voice, everything they do. They can extend your body directly into cyberspace, right?
Yes.
You can start with something like Second Life, for instance.
Yes,
but,
that's right.
So the fact that we have this sort of cyberspace, which is, I think, too frequently viewed as either just a little box, it's just one more tool that I use, or some people, I'm guilty of this, make the computer my whole life, right? And then, you know, it's sort of, your senses are all directly going through this device, which speaks to your it's very, Kantian in a bad way, to go back to what you were saying before about the mind-body connection. It's easy to lose your body, or you know, when you are when your mind is so active in a way which is interfacing with a device totally divorced from
absolutely
physical reality, right?
Yeah. Well, Edmund Carpenter, who, as you know, worked with McLuhan in the 1950s, he was an anthropologist. They co-edited a journal called Explorations. Some of the best essays in that journal were later published as Explorations in Explorations in, that's a good, I can't remember the name, it's Explorations in something. Anyhow, but Edmund Carpenter made this point, which again instantly strikes you as so important and so true, that when we're using media like this, we become angels. Because we're everywhere at once, and it's interesting that in religious, you know, mythology, you know, certainly in Christianity, I think even in Judaism, angels are described as these beings who can be every place at once. And so when we're on television, or when this is on YouTube, it doesn't matter where the person is who's watching it; they're seeing us. And if you have 100 people, or 1,000 people, or 1,000,000 people watching it at the same time, we're there. And McLuhan wrote a lot about this. He called it discarnate man, what you are talking about. And it's the same thought that because we're exchanging information, we to some extent lose sight of our bodies.
Yeah.
Yet it's important to point out that everything we say, everything I'm saying right now, everything you are saying right now is coming through our bodies. So our bodies play an inevitable role. But, what I think is especially, significant, about, everything that we're talking about is, I think that notwithstanding all the work that's been done by people like me, to understand what's going on, we need people like you who are also probing it on the deepest possible level. Because what is 100% true and undeniable is that the speed of technological innovation far outstrips our immediate ability to understand it. That's what the problem is in the first place. And then the problem in the second place, and I try to make this point from time to time, and, you know, again, people first say, what are you talking about? But if you think about it, I think it's right. We understand best that what we grew up with. So you were saying, you were watching on a small screen when, you were a kid and so on. So, what I understand best, is television. Because I grew up with television. I saw television. When I started watching television, it was brand new. And just like my parents, they understood radio better than television. Because to that, and I remember my grandfather a long, long time ago, I guess he understood newspapers better than radio, because he told me once, every time he hears a radio, a part of him wants to look behind the radio, and bear in mind that in his day radios were big things, to see like the man who was hidden crouching down in back of the radio talking. Because it was so new to him. So I've given it a shot. I think I'm, immodestly, I'll say I'm probably better than most people my age in terms of understanding what's going on now, the new things. Mm-hmm. But we need people like you because you indeed are bringing in a fresh approach, and you'll be able to see things that someone like me might well have missed.
Mm-hmm. I'm very happy to have the opportunity because, it takes dialogue. It takes this sort of communication. I'm saying things that I'm thinking of for the first time as we talk. And thanks to my webcam and the fact that we can look at each other and see each other's, right? There's more to it than just voice or text. There's the full, 90% of nonverbal, 90% of communication is nonverbal communication. And so you have a term for media which approaches this layer of transpirability and invisibility,
anthropotropic. That's my term. Yeah, which is often misstated. Even I think Oxford University Press has encyclopedia. Somebody wrote a piece on me and talked about my anthropomorphic theory. Anthropomorphic is a common word. That's not my theory. What anthropomorphic means is we tend to look at things as if they're human. So, like, if a dog whines, we say the dog is sad and the dog misses us and the dog knows that we're going to be leaving in a few minutes.
Or the dog has too much cheese.
Yeah, that's right. But anthropotropic is something different. This is, something I developed when I was, as in my doctoral dissertation, human replay theory of the evolution of media. And I remember I realized when I was actually going for my MA in media studies, not at NYU where I did my PhD, but up the street at the New School for Social Research, in a program that John Culkin, who was one of McLuhan's earliest supporters, and you could even say disciples, that was his program, John Culkin's program in the 70s. So I began developing this idea when I realized, why is it that photography has developed from black and white to color? Mm-hmm. And you've just mentioned another, step in photography. It's developed, obviously, the Polaroid camera was instant, but now it's not only instant, it's like immediately instant. You had to wait for the Polaroid to develop for a couple of minutes, and you couldn't get it anyplace. You had to mail it someplace. Mm-hmm. So why did that happen? Why was radio not replaced by television, but it was inevitable that somebody would want pictures to go with the sound? And there are many, many examples of this. And I realized all these developments had one thing in common. The newer media were more consonant with our biological modes of perception. Mm-hmm. And again, it gets back to perception. So in the natural world, let's say it's a world, let's go back, 30,000, 50,000 years, whatever, in which there are human beings, whether they're Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, and they're not yet writing. All they're doing is talking. And for those human beings, every act of communication is a fully sensory act. In a way that, by the way, what you and I are doing now isn't quite yet either, because we can't shake hands, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not fully sensory. We can't in any way touch each other. Or I'm drinking water, you are drinking water. If you didn't have any water, I had another cup here. I said, hey, would you like some water? Mm-hmm. So these fully sensory acts in the pre-technological world were very satisfying, but there was a big limit. You couldn't do anything beyond biological limits of perception. And so that's why the first technologies were invented. But notice that writing, and this is something that McLuhan wrote a lot about, and he told me he really liked this part of my dissertation. Notice that writing allows us to transcend time and space, right? I can write something down, somebody can read it tomorrow, somebody can read it 100 years from now. Or I can put it in the mail, or I can give it to someone to walk somewhere so someone who's not in my physical presence can read it. But look at the price we pay. Reality, our full sensory perception, is flattened out into nothing, right? Just squiggles on a page. It's flattened in three dimensions of sensory perception are flattened out into one dimension where the only sensory apparatus is sight making sense of these squiggles. So that stage of technology I call stage B, under the pressure to burst out of the biological limitations, we surrender a lot of our full sensory experience in order for the communication to take place. Now, you mentioned the telegraph. So the telegraph is really crucial because the telegraph in many ways is the high watermark of that stage B technology. You're not even dealing with words anymore, right? The words themselves have been flattened out into dots and dashes or beeps and non-beeps, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. that binary code. And then that in turn has to be translated back into words, and that in turn, you know, then approximates the written word. That's the telegraph. But what the telegraph does is it ignites people saying, hey, you know what? I can send my written words to people, but wouldn't it be great if I could send my voice to people? And that's what Alexander Graham Bell does with the telephone. And so that's the beginning of stage C technology. And so the anthropotropic, anthropo meaning human as an anthropology, tropic meaning towards, like plants are heliotropic, they grow towards the light or the sun. So anthropotropic media under human development, as they're developed, try to do two things. Continue the extension across time and space, but retrieve the lost sensory elements.
Wonderful.
So right now you and I have a conversation again, so it's pretty good. This is much better than Alexander Graham Bell's day. We're now talking and we see each other. That's great. Two crucial things, sight and hearing. But we're not yet completely there. Being completely there would be what? It would be some kind of teleportation.
Yeah.
So you and I met each other last week, but I had to fly up to Toronto. You had to get down. And, you know, the ultimate apex of anthropotropic evolution is the merging of talking and walking, meaning, you know, the communication and the physical. By the way, I did want to mention you said something about Second Life, and there is a media theorist by the name of Ken Hudson, who actually lives in the same town as Andrew McLuhan. So Andrew probably knows who Ken Hudson is, and you know I'll send you I can connect you on Facebook.
Sure.
And yeah. Anyway, the reason why I mention this is he. I don't know, maybe about 10 years ago, I don't remember exactly when, he did a series of interviews in Second Life. And among his guests were Eric McLuhan and me, two separate interviews. So you could see my avatar at Second Life.
Awesome.
I am such a cheapskate. You would approve of this, Clinton. I didn't pay for, you know, you can pay like whatever it is. What's it called?
Linden
dollars or something? Or only Bitcoin. And so absolutely not. So I went, you know, cheapo than I am for the free.
That's the way to do bare minimum.
So I just like stuck a mustache and some, you know, face.
Yeah.
And a bunch of hair and whatever, so, and you can see me talking there. Anyway, so, but Second Life is an interesting precursor because they were trying, you know, again, it was not three-dimensional, but in a way, what Second Life, it was you know, like part of the ladder in the anthropotropic evolution towards, greater sensory involvement.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Well put. And I'm just always would like to remain vigilant that while we connect people closer together in these more multi-sensuous modes where we do feel more and more in physical proximity, at the end of the day, I'm right now sitting here all alone in my bedroom talking at a bunch of pixels and a little, speaker diaphragm, and you yourself,
right,
all alone, right, talking to no one. And, if our brains weren't able to put together these dots, in this mosaic of pixels back into someone, right? The autonomy, the control, the humanness is always, at the end of the day, going to be people talking to people. It can be mediated, but more important is to keep that foot that's planted in the immediate, I think, a little bit firmer than to delve directly into cyberspace in a way which people talk about like it's something that's coming. Oh, I bought this VR goggles and pretty soon I'll be able to go into it. No, we've been doing it for decades. This is long gone, right? Just because
there's
a little picture frame that you have to stare at doesn't mean this isn't any less an out-of-body experience than people 100 years ago were having in the movie theater dodging the train coming at their face, right?
Absolutely right. That's a great example. I think it was the Great Train Robbery. it was like 1900. And again, that indeed. But you know what? It's easy to laugh at those people. I used to laugh. I don't laugh at them that much anymore because we're no different. I think it was the remake of The Fugitive. So The Fugitive was an American television series, I guess, maybe late 60s or early 70s. And they made a movie out of it, mid to late 80s, early 90s with Harrison Ford. And there's a great scene where he, jumps off a train because he's trying to escape. And then they switch the shot and he's, on the track and the train is coming at him.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my wife and I were seeing that movie. We both sort of flinched.
Yeah.
So we're no different than the people in 1900, And again, that's good movie making. It's a visceral reaction. That's what they want to the images you see on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, the art of directing is to try and capture the art of the stream of consciousness. It's memories mediated. Right? The same way your mind in a memory edges out the boring parts, you remember the parts that stick, right?
Yeah, by the way, you should read. Here's another recommendation. I'm always full of recommendations in case you haven't seen this book. It's called The Photoplay, and it was written by Hugo Munsterberg in 1915.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting backstory. He was German nationality. The U.S. got involved in World War One. He was a professor at Columbia. He was shunned to some extent, not by everyone, but by some of the faculty and students because he was German. And he was a philosophy professor. But he loved film. And so he took the time that he wasn't in the classroom, even though he wanted to be in the classroom, to write this book, and it's a masterpiece. And it deals with what you and I are just now talking about.
Wonderful. One more book to add to the pile.
There you go.
Wonderful. Well, we've gone a little bit over an hour here. If you've no pressing concerns, I don't mind taking this to an hour and a half, if you would agree.
Let's do it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Fantastic. The first extended episode of Life in the Foam. Another plug, if you like this sort of stuff, you can find a link below, patreon.com. Also, patreon.com/ClinchandTheGeek. Also, last night, I got word that this iTunes has approved this podcast for a syndication on all Apple products. So if you like to listen, you can subscribe on iTunes now.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We're making it. There you go. The anthropotropic principle. I think it's a very powerful explanatory tool, thank you, because as technology grows more anthropotropic in facilitating human communication, without the media awareness of the underlying technology, there is a tendency or the danger of people anthropomorphizing renditions. You got bots, you've got what's called AI or chatbots, you've got this notion of the Turing test, which I think sort of, you know, there's a great danger there in so far as what people can focus their human empathy and their human love and attachment to ever so more anthropomorphically animated fictional cyber things, right? So that's one thing I think was a part of the subtext of the new Blade Runner movie, Blade Runner 2047.
Mm-hmm.
While we're on the topic of that, and the more I think about it, the more I think this can, you can look at this in a broad historical sense, going all well back to maybe the Mechanical Turk, which is that old chess computer, which was actually just a guy in a box with magnets moving chess pieces around, right? But you know, this whole idea of you know, just iconography, even the tendency for humans to anthropomorphize this stuff, which I think McLuhan talked a lot about too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the key distinction is, you know, if you want just something to, you know, epitomize this, is the difference between a parrot talking and a person talking. So, you know, the parrot's words sound like human words. And they sound like human words because they are human words. But there's not human meaning in those words, because all the parrot is doing is mimicking sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no matter how much you want to dress it up, if you're talking, you know, about Siri or, you know, Amazon's little device, Alexa, or even big device, depending upon its size, you know, they're glorified parrots. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's good. They're very useful. You know, we all have now GPSs on our phones, sometimes embedded in our cars. There are voices that talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, it's just a more comfortable program.
Yeah.
And, you know, to get back, you know, I like this lame pun so much, to putting Descartes before the horse. We're not going to have, you know, AI that is in any sense comparable to human intelligence, I think, until we, and this gets back again to your point about hardware, until we know more about how our minds have arisen in our brains.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, that we need that connection.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that always strikes me, you know, and this is apropos, again, of my interest in religion in an anthropological sense. There are three big mysteries, I think, in existence itself. And science has not really answered any of these three. It's done a better job, I think, maybe in one than the other two. Anyway, the first one is, how did the universe get here? So the Big Bang theory is no answer at all, because of what caused the Big Bang to happen. Religion doesn't provide much help either, except to say, okay, God created it. Good. What created God? God created himself. Clever, but that's no answer.
Turtles all the way down.
Exactly. So that's one, you know, mystery. Second mystery is, how did life emerge from non-life on Earth? That we probably know the most about, but I try to keep up on, you know, research on this. We still don't yet know exactly how that happened. But the third relates directly to what we're talking about. You know, as I'm sure you know and viewers know, it's been noted for like at least 20 more years ever since we began keeping track of genetic codes. Chimpanzees, great apes, have over 98% identical DNA to human beings. Yet, there's no McLuhan among the great apes or the chimps. Not only is there no McLuhan, there's not even some dummy who doesn't understand McLuhan, you know, in the way that many human beings are. And, you know, there's no Mozart, there's no Isaac Asimov. So the whole history of humanity can be said to have derived from that little over 1% difference in DNA. And that's as far as we've gotten, meaning, okay, that's an interesting recognition, but how did that 1.whatever% DNA arise in a way that it created our brains and our bodies, which led to our minds and in turn our civilization? I think that that's a really crucial thing to focus on. And the way that relates to what you're saying about AI is, no matter how clever, and I don't want to be accused of being a protein chauvinist. I'm not saying that artificial intelligence has to be in a protein form. I'm fully willing to, accept the possibility that some kind of purely digital silicon, whatever it is, form can be the basis of intelligence. But I think we're not going to crack that problem until we know more, a lot more, about how intelligent life, i.e. humans, arose from, I don't mean to diss dolphins and great apes and chimps, but let's face it, they're not intelligent in the way that we are.
Right.
And until we understand how that difference happened, we're not going to get too far with AI.
It's got to be a slow, slow, gradual, over the course of thousands of years, development culturally across, like the memeplex that slowly grows over centuries of enculturation and whatnot until you finally get these breakthroughs like the fire or tools or writing, right? And the slow, gradual, How many things have been forgotten, right? Like, what we know today is what has lasted and survived long enough to become the foundation of the complex, beings mm-hmm. that we are
yeah.
today.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because you mentioned the Silk Code earlier. This is like one of my primary themes in both media theory and science fiction. Mm. Because we've been on this planet a long time. And what you just said is completely right. There's an enormous amount that happened and was understood, that either wasn't recorded at all or was recorded in a form that just didn't last. Not everything was carved on walls or into rocks, and those things are gone. They've deteriorated. Mm-hmm. So, and then of course you have what happened in the ancient library of Alexandria. It was burned at least 3 times. Many unique manuscripts were lost.
Mm-hmm.
We know about anywhere from a third to at most a little less than a half of Aristotle's treatises. And we know that we only know that fraction because lists of all his treatises have survived in other places.
Mm-hmm.
But, Aristotle, pretty bright dude, who knows what he came up with in those other treatises that have been lost to us.
Mm-hmm.
So... And then this gets back again to Hitler, burning books.
Mm-hmm.
One very good thing about the digital age, and, as I'm sure it's clear to you and anyone who has read any of my books or listened to me rave on about things, I'm pretty much an optimist. And one of the things I like about the digital age, with all its flaws, is the fact that I think it's much more difficult to destroy or lose what we have now. I was interviewed, a few months ago for an article somewhere about, digital apocalypses. And could I imagine a world, or could I imagine it happening in our world, that somehow the whole internet was brought down and everything on it was destroyed? And, my answer was, look, anything is possible. So it's not that I can't imagine that. But as far as I know, you can do some very serious things with hacking. You could hack a nuclear energy plant so it blows up. If we have driverless cars, that's going to create all kinds of nightmare scenarios. You might be able to hack into a driverless car and turn it into a weapon. But bringing down the whole internet, I've never seen anything even remotely possible like that. So I think that's good news in terms of the survival of what we have now out there and up there online.
Mm-hmm. Done properly, digital preservation. And this entails things like checksums or verifications to you know, maintain things haven't been tampered with, right? This is sort of your double-edged sword, because yes, computers remember everything, but you can't revise a newspaper. If a newspaper publishes something, it can't be revised. You know, the copy you've got stored under your mattress, you know, 2 months later,
that's when
the story changes or whatnot, right? So yes, there are all of these issues.
Yeah. Let me just point out, I have a concept for that too. And again, in my optimistic way, I say that books and even newspapers have reliable locatability in terms of the text that's in them. So if you turn to page 74 in Digital McLuhan, what you see on that page will be there tomorrow, next month, 10 years from now, I hope 100 years from now, somebody has that book mm-hmm. on her shelf. But things that are online, despite all the weight advantages, they don't have reliable locatability, because a web page can be brought down anytime. YouTube, by the way, is, in my view, an horrendous offender in terms of the lack of reliable locatability. Because over the years, on my blog, I posted things, you know, and links to YouTube videos. And then somebody reads something like 2 years later and said, that YouTube video that you posted is no longer online. So, yeah, the person who posted it brought it, took it down, or someone else insisted. Mm-hmm. So that can't happen with a newspaper.
Well, this podcast is being hosted on archive.org. Which is the internet's preeminent, right? If there's a place that's not going down, come hell or high water, it's the foundation. I shouldn't say it's the Library of Alexandria of the internet. That's a terrible precedent. But
something else. Okay, so then let me say to everyone who's watching this, if the world is burning and a lot of things are being destroyed, and the only thing you have to watch is this podcast, hang in there. There's hope. You'll make it.
At least we'll survive. That's it. All right. Absolutely. Wow. Wow. This is absolutely wonderful. Let's see. Well, what ties everything together here? We've got about 10 minutes. Yeah. So it's been very interesting trying to retroactively use the ideas of Marshall McLuhan, especially the ideas of the medium is the message. To think about just what computers have done to me or to us. You know, I grew up, as soon as I got a computer, age 6 or 7, I was hooked, right? And my mom would always complain, oh, what happened, right? Everyone's in their bedroom all day, you know, like, when you're right. So these sort of issues sort of sprung up immediately. And as I was editing my documentary series, I was watching hundreds of hours of YouTube documentaries on computers from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, finding clips where I could build meaning together to try and rehash the story of computers here. And really, they're the most complex things we've got. McLuhan would use these metaphors to describe the television. Like, there's a finger reaching out of the TV, you know, caressing your face and entering your mind, right? You're being touched by you know, this light entering you. He would say, television viewer is the screen upon which things are being projected into them, right? And I mean, mm-hmm. all that holds true for the computer, but only at the highest level, only at the most immediate visible thing. So when computers started with hobbyists, everyone knew what was happening inside, because you had to, right? And then slowly they became easier to use. And then as more and more, Alan Kay likes to say that technology is anything that was invented after you were born. So people who are born with computers, and I mean, there's 12-year-olds today who have never known a world without smartphones. Whereas I can think of in high school, no one was sitting around, except me, with the pocket computer, you know, right. Messing around, ignoring whatever's going on, right? And so with all these things catching on so fast, I feel like there's always the possibility for the people who are conscious of the change today to fail to pass on things to the next generation of, you know, their observations, which is why I'm so incredibly grateful to read your book, Cell Phone, and the Digital McLuhan, and to talk to our mutual friend, Harold Channer there, who was, likes to talk about life before television, even, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because seeing our environment for what it is means seeing every layer of what humans created and built up. And
Well, a couple of things there. Actually, let me just get back to something you said that at earlier in our conversation just now. I'll get back to these things. Just like kind of a slightly contrary opinion about the medium is the message. It has often been interpreted as McLuhan saying content is totally unimportant. And I think that that's not correct. I don't think McLuhan meant that. He did say content is the juicy meat that the burglar throws the watchdog so to distract the dog so the burglar can enter the house and steal whatever he wants to steal. And so McLuhan was emphasizing the fact that we ignore the underlying medium because we pay too much attention to content. But if you think about it, you couldn't have a medium without content. In other words, if you have a television and you turn it on and nothing happens with it, well, I don't know, it's just like a peculiar kind of mirror or whatever that
you'll
you have in your house.
Get bored of the static after a couple minutes and then you'll never
That's
get
right.
Again, yeah.
That's right. If somebody logs on to YouTube and there's nothing there, what is YouTube? Nothing. So, I think it's important to keep that in mind. But then the other point I want to make, which is very important, what you just said, and this also relates to something I was sort of touching on a little earlier. I have like a phrase for almost everything. There's something I call the first love syndrome. And it pertains to various things. The most obvious is one day I ran into someone at a science fiction convention and we were talking about Star Trek. And he was saying, oh man, I just love Star Trek the motion picture. This is like the first Star Trek movie. That movie is held in so low regard that fans refer to it as Star Trek the motion sickness. You know, right? And I was really stunned. I said, you like this movie better than the original Star Trek series? What? And he said, yeah. And then he said, I mean, it's the first Star Trek story I've ever experienced. And then when I went on to see the series, it didn't quite measure up to that.
Oh.
And after that, I've seen over and over again what people first experience and come to love, everything is judged against that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I call that the first love syndrome. This is why about, you know, these endless arguments, which is better, you know, Lord of the Rings, the novel series, Lord of the Rings, the movies. The answer is, it's based on what you experienced first.
That's very poignant, because there you go. That's excellent, because something that has changed in the past 20 years with broadband internet is the ability for everyone to experience the past, you know, all the culture in the world completely out of order in their own idiosyncratic way. And so the barriers to having something to talk about with your friend is sort of increased by that complication. It's sort of like this is what this is about. Life in the foam. And life in the foam is to have your own pathway through this infinite cyberspace, which is your own story of discovering the world around you and culture and involvement, but just with this added complication of the non-linear temporality that mass media brings together, where everyone watched JFK's funeral at the same time, right? It was a recent event. But when you got 500 channels on the television and you've got, you know, that series from 2 years ago on Netflix, you're only catching up to now, all right? So that's why...
Exactly.
In the immediate world, face-to-face conversation and human interaction, that needs to be your, firmly planted foot, because more and more, I think, cyberspace and the digital world that we see through screens and through VR soon, that's going to be more and more of a maelstrom that people are going to have to swim their way out of maybe sometimes if they get too deep into. So that about wraps it up. I think this has been a fantastic hour and a half. Thank you very much, Professor.
I enjoyed it immensely.
So I've been speaking to you here on Life in the Foam with Professor Paul Levinson, who studied under Neil Postman, media ecologist. You are What is it you told me? You were his.
Listen, Postman, Neil Postman was a great teacher, one of the best teachers I ever had. But I failed to persuade him in the slightest that, for example, he thought computers were another version of television. He became an extremely hostile critic of all technologies, including digital media. So as you can tell, I'm very persuasive, right? Mm-hmm. But I was unable to persuade Postman. So I often say that Postman was my biggest failure for me as a teacher.
Well, your optimism is welcome here, sir. Thanks again. And join us on the next episode of Life in the Foam, coming soon.